When Molotov returned to the Kremlin, Stalin walked up to his office to congratulate him.
"Well, you sounded a bit flustered, but the speech went well."
Molotov needed praise. He was much vainer than he looked. Stalin himself deliberately disappeared from the public eye. His appearances on the front page of Pravda fell dramatically. When a decree named him as commander-in-chief, he substituted Timoshenko's name instead. Attended by Molotov, Malenkov, and Beria, the threesome who were to spend most of the war in the little corner, Stalin gradually learned of the startling German successes and the Soviet collapse. During that first week, Beria, master of the special department responsible for hunting down traitors, met Stalin 15 times, while Mekhlis, political boss of the army, virtually resided in the little corner. Terror was Stalin's solution to defeat. It was the disaster of the Western Front, where General Pavlov had lost contact with his troops, that reduced Stalin to wild, if impotent, fury. "This is a monstrous crime. Those responsible must lose their heads." Stalin abruptly ordered his most trusted cronies to travel to the fronts and find out what was happening. When they hesitated, Stalin shouted, "Immediately!" Chief of Staff Zhukov headed for the southwestern front. Malenkov and Budioni flew to Bryansk, Kulik to the western front. Only Zhukov, brutal, courageous, and energetic, managed to counterattack on the southwestern front, brandishing the Stalinist ruthlessness that distinguished him throughout the war. "Arrest immediately," reads a typical order about retreating officers, "and bring them to trial urgently as traitors and cowards." The boozy buffoon, Marshal Kulik, outfitted himself in a pilot's fetching leathers, cap and goggles, and arrived on the Western Front like a Stalinist Biggles. Bewildered, he was cut off, surrounded, and almost captured. He had to escape in disguise. The Western Front itself was disintegrating. Ailing Marshal Shaposhnikov collapsed from the strain. Headquarters lost him, too. Stalin sent Voroshilov to find Kulik and Marshal Shaposhnikov. The front's commander, Pavlov, and Shaposhnikov were found in something that looked more like a gypsy encampment than a headquarters. Shaposhnikov lying on the ground, covered by a coat, and Pavlov lying alone beneath a tree, eating out of a mess tin in pouring rain, which he did not seem to have noticed. Voroshilov descended on the camp with an explosion of threats, berating poor Pavlov for his failures. In another of those moments that reveal the importance of personal vendetta, Voroshilov reminded Pavlov that he had once complained to Stalin about him. Pavlov fell to his knees, begged for forgiveness, and kissed the marshal's boots. At dawn, on the 4th of July, Mekhlis arrested Pavlov for treason. Stalin welcomed this as one of the true ways to improve the health of the front. Under torture, Pavlov implicated General Meretskov, who was immediately arrested too. Before Pavlov's trial, Paskryabyshev brought Stalin the draft sentence. Stalin said, "I approve, but tell Ulrich to get rid of all that rubbish about conspiratorial activity." The case shouldn't drag out. No appeal. And then inform the fronts so that they know that defeatists will be punished without mercy. On the 22nd of July, the four commanding officers of the Western Front were shot. So many telegrams flooded in asking permission to shoot traitors that the wires to Mekhlis' office were blocked. He told the senders to sentence and shoot their own traitors. Stalin was absorbing the scale of the catastrophe. The fronts were out of control. The Nazis were approaching Minsk. The Air Force decimated. 30 divisions shattered. On the 26th, Stalin urgently recalled Zhukov from the southwestern front. The chief of staff found Timoshenko and General Latutin standing to attention before Stalin, their eyes red from lack of sleep. Stalin ordered, "Put your heads together and tell me what can be done." He gave them 40 minutes to propose new lines of defense. The Germans, who had penetrated 300 miles into Soviet territory, encircled 400,000 troops, and took the capital of Belorussia, Minsk. Stalin was beside himself. The fall of Minsk would open the road to Smolensk and Moscow. But such was the rout that Timoshenko again lost contact with the armies. This infuriated Stalin, who led his team into Timoshenko's office at the Defense Commissariat and announced that he wanted to acquaint himself personally with the reports from the front. Zhukov was about to leave, but Timoshenko gestured for him to stay.
"What's happening at Minsk?" asked Stalin.
"I'm not yet able to report on that," replied Timoshenko.
"It's your duty to have the facts clearly before you at all times and keep us up to date," said Stalin. "At present, you're simply afraid to tell us the truth."
At this, the fearless Zhukov interjected rudely, "Comrade Stalin, have we permission to get on with our work?"
"Are we perhaps in your way?" sneered Beria.
The meeting now degenerated into a row between Zhukov and Beria, with a bristling Stalin standing in the middle. Finally, Stalin could no longer contain his fury, yelling at Zhukov, "You're making a crass mistake trying to draw a line between yourselves and us. We must all be thinking how to help the fronts. What is General Headquarters? What sort of Chief of Staff is it who, since the first day of the war, has no connection with his troops, represents nobody, and commands nobody?" The granite-faced Zhukov collapsed under this barrage and burst into tears, sobbing like a woman. He ran out into another room. Molotov followed him. One of the harshest Bolsheviks comforted one of the most severe soldiers of that bloody century. 5 minutes later, that incongruous duo returned. Zhukov was quiet, but his eyes were moist. Stalin suggested that someone be dispatched to make contact with the Belarusian front. He was very depressed. Then he looked at his comrades. "Let them get it sorted out themselves first. Let's go." As Stalin led the way out of the office, he uttered his first words of truth since the war began. "Everything's lost. I give up. Lenin founded our state, and we fucked it up." Stalin cursed all the way to Kuntsevo. He said he could no longer be the leader. He resigned. At Kuntsevo, Molotov tried to cheer him up. They left the broken Stalin sulking at the dacha. Mikoyan was not impressed with this performance. On the way home, he discussed it with Molotov, whom he disliked but trusted. "We thought he said it for effect." They were right that Stalin was partly performing, but he was a human being too, in Molotov's words. The fall of Minsk jolted Stalin, who lost face in front of his comrades and generals. This was the gravest crisis of his career. The next day they discovered it was not merely for effect. At midday, when Stalin usually arrived at the Kremlin, he did not come, nor did he appear the following day. The vacuum of power was palpable. The Titan, who decided every tiny detail, left a gaping hole. As the Germans advanced, the government was paralyzed for 2 long days. Molotov, Beria, Malenkov, and Voroshilov met to arrange what to do. The dynamic Beria devised a new super-war cabinet with sweeping powers, an ultra-politburo with a tiny membership of just the four of them, and chaired by Stalin, if he would accept it. The exclusion of many of the magnates was a triumph for Beria and Malenkov, who were not even full Politburo members. Once this plan was complete, the Politburo gathered. The magnates had never been so powerful. This was the only real opportunity they had had to overthrow Stalin since the revelation of Lenin's damning testament almost 20 years earlier. Molotov told them about Stalin's breakdown. But Mikoyan replied that, even if the Vucht was incapacitated, the very name Stalin was a great force for rousing the morale of the people. But Bumptious Voznesensky made what ultimately proved to be a fatal mistake.
"Vyacheslav," he hailed Molotov, "you go ahead and we'll follow you."
Molotov must have blanched at this deadly suggestion and turned to Beria, who proposed his State Defense Committee. They decided to go out to Kuntsevo. When they arrived, they were shown into the little dining room. There, sitting nervously in an armchair, was a thinner, haggard, gloomy Stalin. When he saw them, he turned to stone. He looked at them searchingly and asked, "Why have you come?" Stalin looked alert, somewhat strange, recalled Mikoyan. "I had no doubt. He decided we had arrived to arrest him." The magnates were frightened, too. Beria later teased Mikoyan for hiding behind the others. Molotov, who was the most senior and therefore the most exposed to Stalin's vengeance, stepped forward.
"We're asking you to come back to work."
"Yes, but think about it," answered Stalin. "Can I live up to people's hopes anymore? Can I lead the country to final victory? There may be more deserving candidates."
"I believe I shall be voicing the unanimous opinion," interjected Voroshilov. "There's none more worthy."
"Right," repeated the magnates. Molotov told Stalin that Malenkov and Beria proposed to form a state defense committee.
"With whom at its head?" Stalin asked.
"You, Comrade Stalin." Stalin's relief was palpable. The tension left his face. But he did not say anything for a while. Then,
"Well?"
Beria stepped forward and listed the members. Stalin noticed Mikoyan and Voznesensky had been excluded, but Beria suggested they should run the government. The pragmatic Mikoyan, knowing that his responsibilities for army supply were relevant, asked to be a special representative. Stalin assigned industries. Malenkov took over aeroplanes, Molotov, tanks, Voznesensky, armaments. Stalin was back in power. So had Stalin really suffered a nervous breakdown, or was this simply a performance? Nothing was ever straightforward with this adept political actor. The breakdown was real enough. He was depressed and exhausted. It was not out of character. He had suffered similar moments on Nadia's death and during the Finnish War. His collapse was an understandable reaction to his failure to read Hitler, a mistake which could not be hidden from his courtiers, who had repeatedly heard him insist there would be no invasion in 1941. The military collapse had also revealed the damage that Stalin had done, and his ineptitude as commander. The emperor had no clothes. Only a dictator who had killed any possible challengers could have survived. In any other system, this would have brought about a change of government, but no such change was available here. Yet Molotov and Mikoyan were right. It was also for effect. The withdrawal from power was a well-tried pose, successfully employed from Alexander the Great to Ivan the Terrible. Stalin's retreat allowed him to be effectively re-elected by the Politburo, with the added benefit of drawing a line under the bungles up to that point. These had been forgiven. "Stalin enjoyed our support again," Mikoyan wrote pointedly. So it was both a breakdown and a political restoration. "We were witnesses to Stalin's moments of weakness," said Beria afterwards. "Yosef Vissarionovich will never forgive that move of ours." Mikoyan had been right to hide. Next afternoon, Stalin reappeared in the office a new man, committed to play the role of warlord for which he believed himself specially qualified. On the 1st of July, the newspapers announced that Stalin was the chairman of the State Defense Committee, the GKO. Soon afterwards, he sent Timoshenko to command the Western Front, defending Moscow. On the 16th of July, he restored the dual command of political commissars that the army so hated, who were to conduct ceaseless struggles against cowards, panic-mongers, and deserters. But these overweening amateurs often took actual command, like their master. "The defense commissariat," said Khrushchev, "was like a kennel of mad dogs with Kulikh and Mechlis." Meanwhile, Stalin reunited the security forces, the NKVD and the NKGB, under Beria. On the 8th of August, Stalin became Supreme Commander-in-Chief. Henceforth, the generals called him Verkhovny, Supremo. Stalin's new resolve hardly improved the plight of the fronts. Within 3 weeks of war, Russia had lost around 2 million men, 3,500 tanks, and over 6,000 aircraft. On the 10th of July, the German panzers renewed their advance on the gateway to Moscow, Smolensk, which fell 6 days later. The Germans broke through to take another 300,000 Red Army prisoners, but Timoshenko's hard fighting temporarily sapped their momentum. Hitler ordered Army Group Center to regroup at the end of July. As he pressed his advance, in the south towards Kiev and in the north towards Leningrad, Hitler had won astounding victories. Yet none of Barbarossa's objectives, Moscow, Leningrad, and the Donets Basin had fallen. The Soviet army had not been obliterated. While German generals begged him to throw their panzers against Moscow, Hitler wanted to seize the oil and grain of the south. He compromised with a new strategy. Moscow and Ukraine. Faced with the threat of more giant encirclements in the south, Stalin devised draconian measures to terrorize his men into fighting. In the first week, he approved his notorious Order No. 270 that stipulated the destruction of the families of men who were captured. This measure ruined the lives of millions of innocent soldiers and their families, including Stalin's own. On the 19th of July, Berlin announced that amongst the teeming mass of Soviet prisoners was Yakov Dugashvili. Stalin was sent a photograph of Yakov that his father examined closely, tormented by the thought of his weak son breaking and betraying him. "The fool, he couldn't even shoot himself," he muttered to Vasily. Soon afterwards, under Order No. 270, Yakov's wife Julia was arrested. Her three-year-old daughter did not see her mother for 2 years, yet we now know how Stalin fretted about Yakov's fate and how he mulled over it for the rest of his life. Around the time of Yakov's capture, Stalin made his first approach to Hitler. He and Molotov ordered Beria to sound out the Bulgarian ambassador, Ivan Stamenov, via an intermediary to find out why Germany had violated the pact, on what conditions Hitler would end the war, and whether he would be satisfied with Ukraine, Belarusia, Moldova, and the Baltics. But the Bulgarian never passed on the message to Berlin, saying, "Even if you retreat to the Urals, you'll still win in the end." Meanwhile, the German advance in the south was inexorable. The panzer pincers of Army Group South under Guderian and Kleist swung round Kiev to encircle General Kirpanos's southwestern front with hundreds of thousands more men. It was obvious that Kiev would have to be abandoned, but on the 29th of July, Stalin summoned Zhukov to discuss all fronts. Paskryobyshev ominously said the meeting would not begin until Mekhlis had arrived. When the gloomy demon appeared with Beria and Malenkov, the chief of staff predicted that the Germans would crush the southwestern front before turning back to Moscow. Mekhlis interrupted to ask, threateningly, how Zhukov knew so much about the German plans. "What about Kiev?" asked Stalin. Zhukov proposed abandoning it. "Why talk nonsense?" bawled Stalin. "If you think the chief of staff talks nonsense, then I request you relieve me of my post and send me to the front," Zhukov shouted back. "Who gave you the right to speak to Comrade Stalin like that?" snarled Mekhlis. "Don't get heated," said Stalin to Zhukov, "but since you mentioned it, we'll get by without you." Zhukov gathered his maps and left the room, only to be summoned back 40 minutes later to be told that he was relieved as chief of staff, to be replaced by Shaposhnikov. The unfolding disaster around Kiev soon proved the wisdom of Zhukov's nonsense. Kleist and Guderian's panzer groups 1 and 2 linked up 100 miles east of Kiev, sealing 5 entire Soviet armies in a giant encirclement, the rotten fruit of Stalin's obstinacy. By the 18th of September, Kiev had fallen. Stalin's nerve held. "Plug the hole," he ordered Shaposhnikov. "Quickly."